First, let me thank Gyufrey in particular for giving me an opportunity to speak here. This is some work that was done over the course of last year, and it's only some very preliminary thing. We have put out a paper, but it really is only a first baby step towards understanding to what extent we can represent a Lorentzian space-time based on a tensor network. This is some work done with our postdoc Apan Long, and also two undergraduate students, Siri, and my PhD student G. I'll start with some motivation why I was doing that, and then I will I will begin with saying a very brief introduction of what the AQF, the algebraic quantum field theory, does, and why the tensor network is a very natural and clean way of realizing some of the ideas in AQFT. Then I will show an example based on the free fermions that is built on the tensor network, and show that we're putting it on a flat Minkowski space, the analog of a flat Minkowski space in this discrete space-time, and show how the things like the Unruh effect can be approximated in this case. Then we were interested in some more hopefully non-trivial examples, and so we went in to look up the literature on integrable models, and we realized that people in the past actually have considered the boost operator, things of that sort, in the old literature of the integrable models, and we'll show how these things are related somewhat to what we naively constructed, but there are still lots of mysteries concerning these stuff. And finally, I'll conclude and give an outlook of what might be of interest to do in the future. So to motivate somewhat, what got me interested in tensor network was the connection between tensor network and ADS-CFT correspondence that was being pointed out initially by Brian Swingle a couple of years ago. And the point was that a lot of features of the ADS-CFT correspondence appears to be captured by the tensor network. And for example, the mirror tensor network, at least in some sense, looks like the ADS bulk when it is trying to capture properties of a one-dimensional CFT, or one plus one-dimensional CFT. So there's quite a lot of supporting evidence or nice qualitative pictures that the tensor network seems to reproduce very naturally. Aspects of the ADS-CFT correspondence. But of course, this discussion is basically based on a particular slice in time. It's mostly a snapshot at a given time. And we basically work with Euclidean space-time or Euclidean space. And there were lots of discussions, for example, about what it means by black holes in tensor networks. So there were proposals about regions of a large bond dimension to that mimics properties of black holes. But what I thought was that if we were to understand black hole physics properly, black holes really live in of space-time with Lorentzian signature, particularly the horizon. It's not really a space-like surface, but rather it's a null-like surface. And so I thought if we were to make progress with understanding the ADS-CFT correspondence using the tensor network, maybe it is a good idea to put some effort into actually constructing a tensor network that describes Lorentzian space-time. And so we start with a toy version just to set things up and ask whether we could deal with the Minkowski space to some extent, at least. And another motivation is that these days there are lots of toy experiments toy experimental simulations proposals of analog gravity in some experimental system. So if you can deal with things in a discrete version approximate things to a very good extent in a controllable way, then it does open up many interesting possibilities of assimilating some of these things in an experiment. And so that was what got me interested and tried working with a toy model. So, so in order to talk about Lorentzian space-time, so I thought maybe it's a good idea to know what are the ingredients I have to put in to make sure that it has anything to do with Minkowski space, in particular, with a well-defined causal structure and so on. How do I put these things explicitly into the setup? And so we looked a little into algebraic quantum field theory. So this is a very rough guide, by no means complete. So what I could understand about algebraic quantum field theory is that it's a set of rules to attach some algebra to some space-time M. And so you need to have some constraints. In order to do that systematically, in general, you have to give some. You have to specialize into some class of manifolds. Not everything goes. And so these are the usual set of requirements that you put into the manifold that that people actually deal with. So first of all, for example, M is some topological space that is Hausdorff, connected, and paracompact. I don't know how every line here has a manifestation on the tensor network, but at least some parts of it would have a manifestation naturally on the tensor network. So the first line in particular, connected and paracompact, I think it is sort of well-defined on the tensor network. I'm not so sure about what it means by being Hausdorff in this space. But anyway, M has a metric defining a causal structure with causal curves. Causal curves includes time-like and null-like curves. And so there is a well-defined meaning to say two points are either space-like separated or causally connected. They are space-like separated if they cannot be connected by a causal curve. So this thing, it is something that we will try to define on a tensor network. Then once you have notions of a space-like and time-like separated points, then you could define Cauchy surface. We believe that so this manifold M is assumed to have a Cauchy surface foliation that looks like some space-like that locally it looks like some space-like surface times R, which is a time-like direction. And it also defines a directed set, namely that there is a notion if I have O1 and O2 belonging to B, then there exists a bigger set such that it contains both O1 and O2. This really just means there's a notion that a set is contained in another set in the manifold M. And so it does. So this would mean something for the algebra that you attach to this manifold. So we have given a list of constraints or requirements on the manifold. Then what about the algebra that you are ultimately to attach to this manifold? Basically, the AQFT attach some algebra to every regions in the manifold. So it attached some algebra U to every region in the manifold. This algebra is usually taken to be a C star algebra. C, I think, means something like norm closed. It has something to do with limits that I don't want to go into here. Talking about norms, so we have to define what it means by norms for these operators. And so usually we think of this as having a Hilbert space, H, and on the Hilbert space, there is an inner product that you could define. And these norms of the operator is basically the maximal value of an inner product of psi, where psi is acted on by A, and psi is any vector inside the Hilbert space. And you can define the adjoint of an operator basically by the usual way. So So here we say that we want to attach some operator to these different regions in the manifold. And so because the manifold has several some properties, so we have to make sure that these properties are realized in the algebra that we attach to the manifold. And so one important thing is so-called isosceny. Basically, that because the manifolds themselves has this notion of a directed sets, we want our algebra to respect that relationship. So if the algebra attached to region O that is contained inside O prime should also be a subalgebra of U O prime. The third requirement is that it satisfies the so-called Einstein causality or locality. And what that means is that if two regions are causally disconnected, where they cannot be connected by any causal curve, then the algebra attached to O, the operators in O, in UO, and the operators in UO prime should commute. This is something that we unconsciously always assume to be true. Maybe at least not, maybe there would be subtleties if we deal with gauge theories or gravity, but I think this is generically taken to be true. Fourth is the time slice axiom. What it means is that if I have a causally convex neighborhood of a Cauchy surface, then the algebra that you attach to this slice near a Cauchy surface is already isomorphic to the entire algebra to the entire spacetime manifold. So this is so much.
Can you say more? So n is what?
N is a so imagine that.
Blackboard right there.
Oh yeah, sorry. Oh, these are batteries. Oh, sorry. So, if I have this is a Cauchy surface. So, let's draw something like this. The Minkowski spaces is one Cauchy surface. Then I look into a neighborhood of this surface, and the algebra that I attach to this surface is already isomorphic to the complete algebra of this spacetime M. Why? Because basically because different slices are related to each other by some time evolution. And so if I have the notion of a Cauchy surface, then every other Cauchy surfaces would be related to some initial a Cauchy surface at some particular point in time, whatever time means, by unitary map. And therefore you don't so the entire algebra of M is completely determined by a single Cauchy surface. So this is also something that we would want to impose on the tensor network.
So do I need to think of this algebra as acting on a Hilbert space?
When they phrase it, they don't really talk about Hilbert space.
Okay.
But for me, I always think in terms of Hilbert space. Just keep it that way for now. Are there any other questions or objections? Okay. So how do we put these notions some of these notions into the tensor network? So a tensor network is basically just a contraction of lots of tensors. So about Hilbert space, I do think that there is some kind of vector space on each link. And so there is some operator that I could act on each of these links. So there is some notion of defining, attaching some operator algebra to certain regions in this network. And so that would play the role of this UO for some collections of links that would be some spacetime regions that we call O. But the tensor network is a map. Basically, it defines for you a linear map between links. And therefore, very much like in the case of the AQFT, operators in different regions are not necessarily independent. And that is where this time slice axiom is eventually should come in. So how do we understand this map? So first of all, I have to have something. So in order to talk about Cauchy surface, I need to have some notion of causal structure. So how do I define what it means by two things being causally connected or having causal curves? So the way I understand it is, suppose I require that every tensor on this network, every tensor on this network only has a unitary, is only unitary if for one particular separation of the vertices. So for example, if I require that only along the map between these lower two links to these upper two links is unitary, but no other separation is unitary, then it becomes possible to define a causal relationship between between different links. All I need to ask is that if I move an operator, so I can map an operator across, I can map an operator to different links. All I need to do is just sandwich this operator by a pair of these tensors, then I would be able to essentially, so this operator initially is on the lower end of this tensor. By sandwiching it on T dagger and T, I have essentially moved it up to the other side of T, right? So you can push these operators across by these unitary maps. And if there's only one direction that is unitary at each vertex, then I could ask if given any two links, whether I could push to that particular link from this initial link by a series of maps of unitaries. If I could, then they are causally connected. And if they're not, then they're not causally connected. If I make such a rule, if I put in such a rule, then I have a notion of Cauchy surface. I just need to find a collection of links such that no two links can be related by a set of can be related by a set of unitary maps. And so therefore, such a definition would naturally and such a definition would naturally give you something of this sort. So this is clearly an example of a Cauchy surface. But then you can draw many different shapes, and you could check easily verify that they also satisfy the properties being a Cauchy surface. Moreover, I could talk about causal diamonds. I could attach an algebra to this diamond. But again, because of the unitary relationship between operators, the actual algebra that I'm attaching to this diamond is completely defined by the small Cauchy surface within this diamond. Basically, all the collection of links that are the maximal collection of links that are not related by any unitary maps within this diamond. And so I would be giving a rule to attaching. What do I mean by attaching an algebra to each regions in space time? Now I've defined Cauchy surface. Then we can see that the time slice axiom on the Cauchy surface is true, because any other Cauchy surface, so for example, this Cauchy surface and this yellow Cauchy surface are clearly related by a set of unitary maps. And therefore, the operator algebra attached to this flat Cauchy surface would be related to the yellow Cauchy surface by a unitary map. And so they are isomorphic, and therefore I recover the time slice axiom. Then what do I mean by observers on these tensor networks? Now, I don't really, I don't have a time, in general, I don't have a time-like killing vectors anymore. Here, I'm still keeping some discrete time-like evolution. But in general, what I would mean by a given set of observers would be a collection of Cauchy surfaces. And that would define for me what I mean by an inertial observer or some accelerated observers. So that is how I understand what it means by that's how I would define observers on this tensor network. A question? Yes.
Did you make some kind of statement about the global structure of the network? Like when you,
So you said that I can see how your definition corresponded to being space-like.
Oh, right.
And then you said the biggest space-like separation you can get at a county service.
Yes, the maximal set of lengths that cannot be related by
a
unit. Sorry?
Does that necessarily follow?
No, it doesn't. Even for manifolds, it is not necessary that there's a Cauchy slice, that it admits Cauchy slice. But only in these cases, there's a well-defined, at least from what I understand, there's a well-defined notion of the algebraic quantum field theory attaching an algebra to this space-time. If it does not satisfy these properties, then you might run into maybe closed time-like curves, I don't know. But then things would be tricky. So these are good tensor networks or good space times that you want to work. Okay. So having set the rules of the game, then I would. So the reason for defining these things is such that I could talk about. Ultimately, I want to talk about inertial observers and Rindler observers on this network, and so and that is the reason why I wanted to define for myself what I mean by Cauchy surfaces and what I mean by observers, and that is for the toy model that I'm going to talk about next.
Is it fair to say that so far this time model consists of a quantum circuit?
Yes.
And then time slices of the quantum circuit?
Yes, I think so.
But now you want to add some notion of space-time? As in some metric, or
so we still don't have metric. So everything distances is
so far we don't have that, but that's
right. So we have a notion of a causal relation, so a time sequence, and we also have a notion of some notion of unitary evolution. Depending on how I put my slice, I have some unitary evolution. It might not preserve that there might not be a time translation invariance, but nonetheless, each step of the evolution is unitary. I wanted to say one more thing, and that is, ultimately there would be some notion of distances like a metric, but that only came after I have the model and compute correlation functions. So other than from the correlation functions, I don't know if there's any other way of seeing the metric emerging from the network.
Actually, there's an approach which is called causal sets.
Right. Actually, I'm sorry.
Where basically you have causal, where if you know all the causal structure, you know the metric, at least the conformal metric.
I see.
So basically, which is a kind of a theorem by Mallarmé or something. That's basically the basis of these causal sets. So you do fix the conformal metric in this case, and you need only the volume information, basically.
I see.
Which in causal sets is postulated that each point is one unit of volume, and then you have the metric.
I see.
What I'm a bit skeptical about is this connection of the definition of causality you had,
mm-hmm.
because you say it's if you have a unitary transformation.
Right.
And it's not quite clear to me that you can really see if you have really a link which seems to be at least null connected, that you can two links which are null connected, that you could really
right. Say here and here, but they are connected by a unitary.
Okay, so that counts as unitary.
Right. So it just means that if each of these tensors, they don't map only one link. They always include multiple links. But as long as there is one map that would take this link with some other links as well to this link, then they would be causally connected. This definition is only based on practical considerations, because if I look into the quantum states and look at this evolution, then I would find that after one step, this site here is indeed influenced by this site, and therefore they are causally connected in a practical sense.
It's not clear to me that a non-unitary map wouldn't result in something that you would like to call a causal relationship.
Exactly. So if it is not unitary, then it would not have any direct relationship with causal relations.
I'm a little confused, because if I'm using like a plain
more familiar quantum mechanics. Like I could take a wave function and map it by some non-unitary to some crazy mixed state.
Okay.
And I would view that as being something that's happened to it. Like that would be a causal influence, wouldn't it?
Oh, but a time evolution is always causal in a closed system. Sorry, it's always unitary in a closed system. Well, if you have the coherence, if it is an open system,
that I'm not sure that the reverse quadratic no causal influence can be captured by a non-unitary Mandel's trend.
I'm not saying that you cannot do something to the system by a non-unitary operator, but in order to say that this is a time evolution, this is part of a time evolution. All right.
I think you could have a trace-preserving completely positive map that would give you a sharp causal structure still. I think you can go beyond unitary evolution.
I see. But,
it means, you know, it's effectively like an dissipation.
Right. But if I think of a closed system,
right.
Then... okay, but...
I wanted to mention, you're saying you haven't thought about metric, only causal structures for power.
That's true.
And that in order to talk about metric, you need to probe
correlation functions, yes.
I want to mention that actually there is a more general way of probing metric, which is directly by looking at the... You can think of this as a path integral in Lorentzian space-time.
Right.
That's what you are building toward, right?
Right.
Path integral. Lorentzian path integral. So you can ask, what's the linear map that these tensors in between the two cards are implementing? And you will see that determines what metric you may have. And all information about two-point correlators will follow from that. So there is a more general approach that does not require two-point correlators to attach a metric to this construction. Instead of looking at how a two-point correlator, or what's the result of inserting, looking at two-point correlators,
right.
You can look more generally at what the linear map is that is being implemented between two Cauchy surfaces.
Right. I see. So when we thought about this, we just throw in some tensors and see how distance came out of it. I want to apologize. I think I have missed out lots of references. It was prepared in a rush. I'm so sorry. We were actually influenced by many papers in the causal set literature. Sorry about that.
Is there a way to see by looking at this whether points are null related as opposed to just causally related?
I'm not able to unless I look into the correlation functions. And as we change the Hamiltonian, we could see that the null cone can change in size. So one lesson that we learned here is that the tensor network, the picture itself, doesn't directly tell you the complete structure of space-time. So this is like the bones, the skeleton of space-time, but the tensors are the muscles. By putting in different things into the tensor, you could totally change the size of the light cone. So this gives you the maximal size of the light cone. It says signals cannot travel faster than this limit set by this individual map in principle. But then you could change the size of the light cone by changing what values of the tensors that you actually put in.
But say once you put all the tensors in, what's the definition of null separated?
The way I view it is I don't know how to if signals could in that particular model could travel is actually traveling slower than the graph allows. Then maybe the effective light cone really is not what you see on the graph, but what is in the model. I am not able to tell a priori. I don't know if there's a way to tell a priori.
But how does it work? I mean, that some tensor there is not a unitary map in the up direction.
They are unitary in the up direction, but then the effective light cone could be smaller than what you see on the graph. So for example, this is a model, the free fermion model that I'm going to talk about. And in some values of some coefficients, I'll go back a few slides and see what the C is. You can see, oh, there's a very nice light cone, and it almost looks like the correlation function has these nice hyperbolas. It's a discrete lattice, but it looks like I have Lorentz invariance. But on the other hand, in the other limit, the whole model is not dispersive at all. And so so as you interpolate between C equals 0 and C equals 1, you would visibly see that the light cone is shrinking. And so a priori, the graph allows you a maximal light cone of a size 45 degrees here. But in practice, it doesn't really span. It doesn't necessarily span that size. I have a feeling that it is related to some something that Xiaoliang Qi mentioned, that there is some effective causal structure by changing. So having determined the graph, there's still some notion of effective causal structure that is determined by the parameters. And a priori, I wouldn't know that the light cone is so small in this case without solving for the spectrum.
So just to clarify, these are the light cones which come from your first definition of causality, or
this came from the model.
From the correlation functions.
That's right. This is a computation.
So the definition you had is kind of a kinematical thing which doesn't.
The light cone ultimately is always smaller or at best equal to the maximal size that I defined on the graph.
Okay.
But there's effectively, it could be effectively smaller. The toy example that we worked with, the first toy example we worked with, were free fermions. So the first thing that we did is that we basically put some fermion states on the on a given slice, and then the Hamiltonian, the unitary transformation, the unitary evolution that we are taking takes the following form. So this equation here is really just identical to the picture here, that this crosses are shifted by one side between two layers. And each of this U is basically just the nearest neighbor interaction between two sites. In the tensor network literature, I think there are considerations of this kind of models or in quantum simulations. But usually, this is taken as an approximation of e to the iht, the Trotter formula approximation. But here, we are just taking it as a definition of this model. Then we solved it. So what we are doing is that first of all we take these flat like Cauchy slices and solve for all the modes. We're going to need to define what we mean by ground state, because these things are only preserve a discrete time translation, and therefore there's no notion of a notion of ground state has to be defined. It doesn't come naturally, but then we find that there are natural definition that there are natural candidates for ground states, and that would totally affect this thing called Riesch-Schneider theorem that comes at the end if I have a time to talk about it, and then we will try to define Rindler observers, and finally define what we mean by boost operator that connect inertial observers and Rindler observers. We'll also solve the spectra of this boost operator, and then we look into the spectrum of this boost operator and compare it with the modular Hamiltonian of half space entanglement, and show that it's not exact. The modular Hamiltonian and the Rindler Hamiltonian that we define here are not exactly the same, but they are sufficiently depending on what your standards of what sufficient means, sufficiently close, as I'm going to show you. So basically, to solve the complete spectra of this flat or Cauchy surfaces. So you basically is more or less like what you do in continuous space, except and do a Fourier transform because of a discrete translation invariance. So it boils down to some recursion relations that you can solve. And so what you get would be a pair of eigenvalues. And you one could see that these eigenvalues comes in complex conjugates. And so here comes our definition of the vacuum. So it is very natural to attach so one of these eigenvalue with a set of annihilation operators and the other set of eigenvalues with a creation operator. And the dagger or the adjoint of this creation annihilation gives you creation and vice versa. And so I would define the state that is annihilated by this AP and BP to be what I call the vacuum. This only comes from a definition. It comes from it cannot come from there's no natural notion of a vacuum state. So in particular, there's a very simple limit. The picture that I show you where there's a very nice light cone is the limit where this coefficient C, C came from here, goes to zero. When C goes to zero, this lambda plus minus looks like e to the plus minus ip. So it almost looks like we're talking, so if lambda is to be interpreted as e to the I e t, then it looks like that we have some form of linear dispersion at c equals zero. And for c equals one, lambda becomes just one, and it becomes non-dispersive, and which explains the correlation function that we would see later on.
Are this CNS cosine and sine of some angle?
Yes.
So
it's here.
So is it possible for you to actually take this definition of the unitary operator? You have a unitary operator, right?
Right.
And it's the exponential of some Hamiltonian?
Yes, okay.
So suppose that you change these gates mm-hmm. to Euclidean time evolution gates. Do you think that you would get...
A Euclidean model also. Sorry.
That the fixed point of this evolution, which now will have a fixed point, will correspond to the vacuum that... The state that you define as a vacuum?
Well, this is a very good question. I don't know about this model, but the thing that I'm going to show for the integral model, the answer is yes. And there, so here, because I, so here, delta t is some parameter of this model, and in principle, it looks like I do want to, maybe there's some notion of analytic continuation or something. Well, this delta t, it really is the number of steps that I have evolved in time. So supposedly is discrete. So the notion of analytic continuation is less well-defined. But in the case of the integral model, there's a very nice candidate for analytic continuation, and that is the spectral parameter. And so it almost plays the same role as this delta t, and it naturally gives you what you want.
But I'm not necessarily thinking about analytical continuation, which might be the right way to describe this. But if I try to solve the case where the evolution is not unitary, I will have to de-analyze a similar object.
That's true.
Which will lead to the same modes that will de-analyze that object, and then you'll just end up with a different,
Okay.
numbers for the eigenvalues.
Right. So for this case, I haven't checked, but for the case of the integral models, it really there's a Euclidean and Lorentzian version that could be go between. Okay. And so here, this is a picture that I've already showed you. The C equals zero case, we computed the correlation functions numerically, and it looks like there is some emergent Lorentz invariance, and in C equals one is non-dispersive, and so the light cone totally closed up, and everything in between, the light cone would be somewhat smaller than 45 degrees. One interesting thing that is pointed out to us is that our fermion model has a non-standard kinetic term. It's just some evolution that is not based on a local Hamiltonian or Lagrangian.
Remember correct, there's something called slack derivative.
lattice gate theory.
Right.
Which looks like what you are doing. You have long range hopping. And you do Fourier transform, which you get linear dispersion. So what you call as non-standard kinetic has some lattice gate theory analog of slack derivatives.
I see. Slack.
Slack.
Yeah, SLAC. It was discovered by Slack.
Oh, thank you. Right. And so you can tell directly from the explicit solution of the spectrum, there's no doubling problem, and it just have this form. I see.
How do you know this is kind of how you can interpret this as a light cone instead of a Lieb-Robinson velocity?
Lieb-Robinson velocity would be the maximal speed that information could propagate. All I'm saying is that two operators, if they are space-like separated, they have zero correlation.
Also, before I forget, since you are considering this discrete time evolution, seems to be connected with Flockway eigenstates.
So
you have
true. That's true.
So which are periodically a similar thing.
That's true. I guess so. I just I did look at some of these papers, but I haven't completely got around into But actually, this was something that you suggested last October. You said it looks like a Flockway system.
Okay.
Yeah. You made that comment. Sorry. And so the second part, is to talk about boost. So here we're doing something again extremely naive. In a Lorentzian space time, if I want to boost it, then I would be looking into a slice that makes an angle with horizontal slice. So here, what do I mean by a slanted slice? So when I draw it on the graph, then it looks like some kind of letters. So last October, Giffrey pointed out to us that if you do that, then there might be something wrong goes on at the corners. So I think that is totally right. We haven't got a very satisfactory way of coming around it, but we just brute force solve the spectrum of this operator and ask, does it look anything like the spectrum? Does it look anything like the spectrum of Rindler observers? And so at least to some limit, it looks like a spectrum of Rindler observers. And so I think certainly that you have to, if you want to get a better numerical result, then one has to do something to the corners. But without doing that, at least to some extent, it's not totally nonsense. So what we did is this set of maps that is sandwiched between the boosted surface and the flat surface is what we call the boost operator. And so what we do is ask for the action of B on A, and then first of all, the first step is to compute this BA. B dagger, and we find that it looks ugly, right? It's exactly what you expect because of this rough corners. You generate both AP and BB dagger, and in general, you would generate several AP. So that is telling you that the vacuum that we have defined is not invariant under the action of B. It would generate some other AP, and it also generate creation operator. So it means that this boost operator does not preserve. If it only generates annihilation operator, then it would continue to annihilate the vacuum state, and B would be a symmetry. But unfortunately, it generates some BP. But when this Q is sufficiently small, then this thing gets very close to a delta function. And this thing gets very close to a purely oscillatory thing that is almost zero. And so for small q, at least, then it does appear. At least for small q and when c is zero, this is a result that we solved explicitly for c being zero. C equals zero is the easiest thing to solve, as you can see. And when Q is sufficiently small, then the action of B on AP is to rescale P by an overall factor. And then it really looks like what the boost operator does. So then we try to solve for the spectra of the boost. Actually, up to this point, now, once you see that when Q is sufficiently small, what the operator does is to shift, rescale P by some factor, then the spectrum of the eigen operators of the boost operator becomes pretty straightforward. Even though it's discretized, it becomes the wave function becomes a discretized version of the Rindler wave functions. Yes.
What does it mean, even intuitively, that the ground state is almost preserved?
It means that if this operator acts on the ground state, the ground state stays invariant.
How do I see it from that expression?
Right. If I only have the upper line, then it's clear. This line.
Right.
It means that suppose I started with operators that annihilates the ground state. After the action of B, it is annihilated by exactly the same set of operators.
You mean that
A
Q's form into a linear combination of themselves?
Right.
Okay.
And so it means that initially this ground state is uniquely identified by the fact that all the AQ kill it.
I thought you have B diagonals.
This one is bad.
No.
Sorry.
The ground state was identified as the state that is annihilated by all the AP.
Right. I did it for both A and B. So the point is, it's clear here.
Yes, but why is it up? I mean, is the second line small? I don't see.
It's because L is very big, and here, if Q is small, this line does not get this line will stay auxiliary.
If Q is small, but the ground state is characterized by being annihilated by.
Good. So as I say, if Q is small, is some kind of looking into a limit of in some sense a continuous limit. Because the wavelength is very long and it doesn't see all these sharp edges so clearly. If its Q is big, then clearly it would be very, very sensitive to these sharp edges and everything falls apart. I totally agree. Right, so up to the point that you're dealing only with sufficiently smooth, sufficiently long wavelength. Then when you solve for the eigenmodes of this B operator, then it would look, these are the wave functions that if you're familiar with the Rindler observers, it would have, it basically have the same form. So then the next step we want, the next interesting question is, so we have ground state and we could compute the entanglement Hamiltonian of this ground state for half of for the half space, we take half of the space, compute the entanglement Hamiltonian, and we could ask, how does it compare with this naive Rindler Hamiltonian and compare with that spectrum? And so the point that we are trying to make here is that it's not that bad. So how do we see that it's not that bad? So let's compute the actual entanglement Hamiltonian. So basically compute the reduced density matrix and take a log. And this is of course, this is done numerically, and you cannot have a huge lattice. And here we have, I think, 20 points. And this is a picture for C equals zero. So we did it for different Cs, but this picture is for C equals zero. And the point is, when you look into the modular Hamiltonian, the entanglement Hamiltonian, it roughly takes this form. I think this is something that has been observed in the literature before. I should have included some more references. I'm really sorry, but the issue is when you're sufficient. So when L is big, and if you are sufficiently close to the edge, then the dependence on the site is roughly linear, And so if you think about the usual form of the boost operator, the usual form of the marginal Hamiltonian in Minkowski space is supposedly related to the boost operator. And so at least when you are less than halfway through the lattice, it looks pretty good. And so we basically look into a fit of this quadratic form with these dots are basically the values of these peaks, and so when we fit it with a quadratic, these numbers came from this fit, and it was not a bad fit.
I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Is L the size of the system subsystem or?
L is the size of the L is the size of the subsystem. It's 10 here, and I think the full thing is something like 20.
I see. So the formula is for half, but the formula below is for half space, not for.
Right. We will talk about full space soon. So on the other hand, in the case where C is approaching one, that modular Hamiltonian still takes this form. So one could ask, so we have explicitly solved for the spectra of the boost operator when C equals zero. So I don't exactly know what this boost operator means to the spectrum when C equals one, where the where it is no longer dispersive, the point that I'm making here is that the modular Hamiltonian still takes qualitatively the same form as in the case where the light cones look explicitly like it is a Lorentz invariant.
So the fact that it's quadratic, that seems like it's more like the conformal boost modular Hamiltonian, like where you have a diamond and you're evolving up like that, as opposed to the half space.
Because I think the issue is that here it's not apparent. Here you only have a finite so the whole lattice is finite size, and so you could see that the two ends are both as you say as an interval, right? So at both ends it should approach the linear form, and so it basically strongly constrains what happens at both ends.
So
and so
fixing,
it must.
You're doing a boost. Well, you're fixing both ends.
What I'm actually solving, clearly I'm doing an infinite size thing, where I'm able to solve analytically. But in this case, I'm doing things only on a lattice, so I'm not able to do it for very large lattice. And so practically, it has to come down. But what I wanted to show you, I hope I still have time, is that in the case of the integrable model, you would see that this really becomes exact. There's no other end to come down to. And that result was exact. It was based on computation of the corner transfer matrix. And we realized the way they got the corner transfer matrix really is very close in spirit to our definition of these boost wedges. Except in their case, it's Euclidean, and the corner transfer matrix is a 90-degree rotation, which is an exact symmetry of the lattice. Here, we are doing some, in Lorentzian space, we want to do some arbitrary boost, and so there's no reason why, so the boost that we do does not respect the exact symmetry of the lattice, and therefore, only in the Q to zero limit, where it doesn't see these sharp edges, does it look sufficiently like a boost. Okay. We also looked into the full modular Hamiltonian, and the full modular Hamiltonian is basically to take the half space modular Hamiltonian and subtract it by the modular Hamiltonian on the other half. And so then you could ask, what happens if what is the commutation relation between this gamma and our eigenmode operators AP? And you could see that under commutation relations, this is x sine p, not sine px. What it does is that it looks like it wants to behave, at least for small p, like dpap. And so here, that there's another mystery here that I hope I would be able to get to when I talk about integral models. So initially, we were very confused. Here it looks like there is a sine p, and so it is not exactly a derivative of ap. But very curiously, when we look into the integral model and look into this commutation relations for integral models, it is an exact derivative of the momentum. But then when we stare at the form of the modular Hamiltonian, they look so similar that we couldn't understand why. In that case, it looks like an exact derivative. And here, it only looks like an approximate derivative. And later, we realized, upon very careful manipulation of those operators, that it has something to do with a different choice of boundary conditions at x going to infinity. And so because when the lattice is infinite, you can always shift stuff that you don't like to to infinity. And so here, I just wanted to highlight is something that we did not totally understand. And that thing is about setting boundary conditions if you have an infinite lattice. It would change the apparent look of these commutation relations. So I have to say, okay, the story up to this part is not completely clean. All we have established is that, okay, we have a set of approximate set of boost operators, and at least for the case of C equals zero, when you that we are able to do analytically, when you compare with the eigenspectrum of this gamma operator, the boost operator is shifting the momentum, and the rescaling the momentum. And here this is PDPAP, and so this operator is also appearing to be rescaling momentum operator. Sorry, this is x sine p really is PDPAP, so it's a rescaling of AP in an infinitesimal way. So up to this point, right. So the similarity that we're talking about works to this not entirely satisfactory extent, but not totally nonsense, to put it that way. Okay. So with only a couple of minutes left, let me say a few words about integral models. So we thought, okay, for free fermions, that is so much that we could do analytically. So are there more general classes of models that we are able to manipulate to some further extent? And so we looked into classes of integrable models. And it turns out that discrete spacetime, people have thought about constructing discrete spacetime using these statistical integral lattice models. The idea is basically to take something called the diagonal to diagonal basis of the transfer matrices to build a tensor network. So the model that we looked into particularly, the six vertex model, the XXZ model, and these parameters, so each link can be either spin up or down, represented by an outgoing or ingoing arrow. And so if you see this graph, if you see this picture, you attach factor of A, that is what this picture means. And they are related to some parameters, and this use called spectral parameter that defines this model, and lambda is some other parameter. It satisfies the Young-Baxter equation, and by transfer matrix, and there's a solution of, so R is basically, defined by these crosses. And so you want to look for some lax operator that satisfy the Young-Baxter equation. And one convenient solution is basically to take L equals R up to some shift of the spectral parameter that I didn't present here. But the bottom line is then you construct these transfer matrices. And here is the point that I wanted to make. In order to go between the Lorentzian model and the Euclidean model, basically, the that the bridge between them is to put an I in the spectral parameter. Without a U, you have a Euclidean path integral, and you can talk about and the spectrum of that Euclidean path integral would select for you the actual ground state when you put stick in either. That is at least true in this set of models. And so the way to construct these tensor networks that is entirely analogous to what we have for the free fermions is based on something that we learned from Fadiev. He already had the idea of building such a tensor network, and he introduced this inhomogeneous transfer matrix that has two sets of L. And after rearranging, then you find that the Hamiltonian is basically taking exactly this form with some little L that is related to the Lax operator by some swap operator. So I'm not explaining all the notations here for now, but what is important is that in order that this is a flat space, he introduced something called the flatness condition on these Lax operators, which are basically defining these Lax operators define each of these small crosses. And this flat connection basically is saying that when you transform this L by U plus and transform so if you transform this L and this Ln here is equals to U plus transforming this L to N, and this L here is equals to U minus is related by U minus transforming this Ln, so they're related. And when you move in a closed circle, they have to be equal to one. That was the flatness condition. I thought maybe if we are dealing with a generic space-time evolution, then some notion of curvature would be realized based on the form of these commutation relations of these operators. Let me just use 2-3 minutes to talk about the corner transfer matrix. So in this kind of integral models, they have a well, the Euclidean version is very well studied, and it is already in the book of Baxter. In the book of Baxter that he saw for the spectrum of this so-called corner transfer matrix. So this corner transfer matrix is basically to one corner transfer matrix is basically to look into all these crosses that is sandwiched between the horizontal line and a vertical line. So that's why it is called corner. And if I take four corners together, then I recover the entire path integral or partition sum of this lattice model. And it was just found that the spectrum of this corner transfer matrices are much easier to solve. And they show that, so suppose there's some symmetry, so assuming some symmetries in this lattice, then A, B, C, D are very simply related. And they show that in the Euclidean version, A is equal to some exponential of some K operator. And this K operator is exactly takes exactly the form that we saw in the K when you look into this entanglement Hamiltonian. It just looks like the site number linear dependence on the site number multiplied by the nearest neighbor interaction in the basically in the quantum Hamiltonian. So if you do Lorentzian rotation, then this model is defining the quantum evolution of the HXXZ model. But now in the corner transfer matrix, it's just related to this nearest neighbor interaction of the XXZ model with a linear dependence on the site number. And so people have used these things. Actually, people already have used these things by Cardi, and actually many other people have blatantly omitted lots of references. They have used these things to compute entanglement spectrum of the quantum state. And so they also have computed the commutations of these. So you can also consider completing these modular Hamiltonian by their by the corresponding copy in their complement, and define this full modular Hamiltonian and look into how it what is the commutation relations with the transfer matrices, and what you will find is that it is an exact derivative of the transfer matrices and the with respect to the spectral parameter. And after converting between the momentum eigenvalue and the spectral parameter, you would find that this is exactly what we were looking for in the property of the Boost operator. But if you do a naive commutation using H term by term with the transfer matrix, then you would actually find that you would have some sine px sine p term that we saw in the fermions. And the reason that they got this is that it really corresponds to shifting things that you don't want to the infinity. And so this is this is the issue that we mentioned earlier, that there's something that we didn't understand about boundary conditions. But if you have proper boundary conditions, then the conformal, then the Boost operator, at least in cases of integral models where you have better control analytically, you can find exact operators that behave like the Boost operator.
Sorry. The form of the Hamiltonian K and the independence remains a uniform electric field.
Right.
That's also related to Boost.
Ah, okay, yes.
So as you are playing uniform electric field, get it out.
I see. It just happens that they solved. Here they solved for this matrix and got this is an exact result rather than any approximation. Right, and there is some interesting story that this set of operators could define some kind of Virasoro algebra, but this is not something I'll talk about. So okay, let me just use in fact, people have also solved for the spectrum of these Boost operators. And you can look into the explicit form of the wave functions and compare it with the wave functions that we found for our Rindler observer. And you'll find that they are basically the same. So finally, let me just make one final comment. I'm sorry, I'm 5 minutes over time, about the Riesch-Schneider theorem. The statement of the Riesch-Schneider theorem is that the ground state has loss of entanglement. It is cyclic and separating, meaning that if you look into any operator that has, if you look into any operator into the operator algebra in a local compact region, you can always find the right set of operators within that local region to act it on the ground state and generate any state in the Hilbert space. So it means that the Hilbert space, the ground state is highly entangled. And roughly speaking, this proof made use of analyticity of correlation functions when they analytically connect the time coordinate to the upper complex plane. And they also assume that this space-time has respects of Poincaré symmetry, and that the spectrum is lower bounded. So not all of these things, in fact, most of these things does not have a direct analog on the discrete space-time, but we saw that our vacuum state actually does preserve loss of entanglement, does have loss of entanglement. On the other hand, in the ferromagnetic state, for these integral models, we can so it is not difficult to solve for the spectrum and compute correlation functions, and you will find that that there are also in the ferromagnetic state of this XXZ integral model, you could also find correlation functions that look exactly like there is Lorentz invariance. On the other hand, this ground state, the reference state with which we computed these correlation functions, it's just all spin up. So this ground state has no entanglement whatsoever. So how is it possible that correlations look like they are look like there is Lorentz invariance, but then in fact there is no entanglement whatsoever. And so we realized that the crucial ingredient in the Riesch-Schneider theorem that protects you from that ensures that you have lots of entanglement in the state is this boundedness of the energy. So only when the state is lower bounded in energy, then there is a natural decomposition of any operator into positive energy, negative energy, and zero energy. And because the state is lower bounded, you can always ensure that it is annihilated by the negative energy operator. And when there is some notion of translation invariance, then this kind of operators are highly non-local. And so by this requirement, we are basically ensuring that the ground state is annihilated by a set of non-local operators, and this is the source of the entanglement that we saw. In the case of the ferromagnetic state, if you solve for the spectrum, then you find that both positive energy states and negative energy states would appear. So positive energy, negative energy would only mean e to the I plus minus EP would both appear. And there's no way to find that there's no natural separation. So basically, in the case of the ferromagnetic state, there's no natural separation between positive and negative energy modes. And therefore, this basically it's this lower boundedness in energy that is not satisfied. And therefore, even though it can have this kind of Lorentz invariant behavior, the grounds that state that we work with basically has no entanglement whatsoever. And so this is some understanding that we gathered after we played with these models. This is basically roughly where we are. So we attempted to put up some tensor network that describes Lorentzian space-time. We have some partial notions of Rindler observers that could be compared with the modular Hamiltonian. And it seems that our toy models do resemble, at least in some limits, to Minkowski space. So we are looking into generalizing maybe to curved backgrounds, to higher dimensions. And also, there is a mystery about bosons. If you're interested, we can talk more about that. So basically, there is some obstruction to building a model of that sort for bosons. This is the end. Thank you.
We're a little over time, so maybe we'll have to. We probably have one question. Does anyone?
Aren't you 1+1? So what's the?
Yes, it's 1+1. Yes.
Like, what's wrong with bosons? Like,
what's wrong with bosons? So basically, you would imagine, I want to build exactly the same set of modes, just like what we did here. So put up some, basically define exactly the same thing, replacing everything by a bosonic operator, and then solve for the spectrum. And no matter what we, so if you follow this through, then there's no way to make sure that the commutation relations of AP, You wanted to define positive energy modes and negative energy modes and make them annihilate the vacuum. But when it comes to boson, you are forced to have one pair of this annihilation creation operator. If you choose AP and AP dagger to have the right commutation relations, AP, AP dagger equals 1, then BP, BP dagger equals minus 1. For the case of fermions, because of this anti-commutation relations, no such problems appear. So it looks like this bosons, it always comes with a pair of modes that has the right commutation relation and the other with a negative sign for the commutation relations. And we looked into the literature somewhat, and people talked about bosons behind the horizon that should take such a form. I don't want to, it's just a, this is just what we found. I don't know.
All right. Like one more time.